the United States and the bicivilized tribes contained the promises that in Indian territory they would never be included in a state or part of a state, where no white man will trouble you, where no ardent spirit will tempt you, and where the land will be yours as long as the grass grows and the rivers flow. Although the Indian Removal Bill did not authorize enforced removal, force nevertheless was used at times, for none of the Indians wanted to leave their old homeland. And today, that difficult journey of indescribable suffering and hardship and loss of lives, one of the blackest marks in American history, is referred to as the Trail of Tears. The Choctaws were the first to be removed. Several of the Choctaw parties had to march through snow 6 inches deep. Travel was very slow and laborious. Sickness was a constant traveling companion of the marchers. Cholera devastated the colonies. Fatality due to hunger and exposure were staggering. 1/4 of the Choctaw tribe, or approximately 3,500, died on the removal trail. Major Armstrong, who was the federal agent in charge of the Choctaw removal, wrote, "No man but one who was present can form any idea of the difficulties that we have encountered owing to the cholera and its dreadful effects. Death was hourly among us. The woods were filled with the graves of the victims and the road is lined with the sick. Fortunately, they are a people that will march to the last, or I do not know how we can go on." The Creeks were next. Torn from their homes, forced to abandon their improvements and most of their personal belongings, the Creek immigrants, caught in a merciless forced government removal program, suffered more than any other tribe on their Trail of Tears. Now in shackles and chains, one party of 300 chiefs and warriors were placed on a riverboat which had already been condemned as unsafe. The rotting craft sank, and unable to swim in shackles all around. By the spring of 1837, 15,000 Creeks had arrived at Fort Gibson. Thousands died in the winter cold on the way to Oklahoma. The severe weather, lack of food, and general suffering killed virtually all infants, small children, and old people. Conservative estimates indicate that 40% of the total population of the Creek tribe died, about 6,000 of them, during the removal and adjustment in Indian territory. It was now the Chickasaw's turn. Living in northern Mississippi, the Chickasaw chiefs were aware that removal was inevitable. And through shrewd and cunning maneuvers, they held out just long enough to wring out of the government commissioners by far the best removal treaty of all the tribes. With a shorter distance to travel and wise management of the removal by tribal leaders, the Chickasaw relocation was most peaceful and orderly, with less suffering and hardship of all the tribes. Chickasaw were able to collect most of their personal possessions, their slaves, their livestock, for transfer to the West. The Chickasaw lost about 900 members, or 15% of the tribe. Next came the Cherokees. The Cherokee Trail of Tears was the most publicized removal in Indian history. Living in Georgia, the Cherokees were progressive and most were prosperous farmers, and they generally ignored the appeals to seek their eastern lands and move west. The enforced removal of the remaining 15,000, which did not remove voluntarily, was entrusted to General Winfield Scott and 7,000 federal troops. On May 10th, 1838, he issued a proclamation to the Cherokee people, warning them that the emigration must begin at once and in haste, and that before another moon had passed, every Cherokee man, woman, and child must be in motion toward the west, as commanded by the President of the United States. A Georgia volunteer, afterwards a colonel in the Confederate service, said, "I fought through the Civil War and have seen men shot to pieces and slaughtered by the thousands. But the Cherokee removal was the cruelest work I have ever known. About 4,000 Indians died or were killed during the course of capture and detention in temporary stockades and during the removal itself. The last of the five civilized tribes to be forced into Indian territory was the Seminoles. Seminole Chief Osceola headed a faction which refused to be bound by the removal treaty and promised that his warriors would fight until the last drop of Seminole blood had moistened the dust of his hunting ground. Chief Osceola carried on a fierce war against the United States and the Florida settlers. He was finally taken prisoner in violation of a truce agreement, and the unconquerable war chief died in chains in 1839. But his followers continued the war, and the United States eventually gave up in their struggle to remove the Seminoles west. By 1842, only 3,000 Seminoles had been removed to Indian territory. For each Seminole removed to Indian territory, it cost the federal government $6,500. Looking at these statistics in another way, for every 2 Seminoles removed to the west, the army paid with the life of 1 soldier. At last, removal of the 5 civilized tribes was an accomplished fact. With bitter sorrow in their hearts, weakened by hardship and suffering, decimated by disease, the Indians now had wistful hope that they would be free from cruelty and harassment, and would be allowed to live in peace, and to restore their broken health and homes, their institutions, and governments. At first, all of Oklahoma was given to the 5 civilized tribes, with the exception of the Panhandle. And as a result of the 5 civilized tribes joining the Confederacy during the Civil War, the federal government claimed that they had forfeited their claim to western Oklahoma and took these lands and gave them to other Indian tribes. For almost 3/4 of a century, the 5 civilized tribes lived in Indian territory as sovereign nations with their own legislative, judicial, and executive branches of government, all with their own impressive capital buildings. 4 of these capitals are still standing: the Chickasaws at Tishomingo, Choctaws at Tuskahoma, Cherokees at Tahlequah, Creeks at Okmulgee, and the Seminole capital at Weewoga burned and has never been restored. The passage of the General Allotment Act of 1887 was a major factor in breaking up the land holdings in the 5 civilized tribes and bringing about statehood. This act provided for Indian lands to pass from tribal ownership to individual owners. Each member was given an allotment and the surplus land sold. While many owners retained and benefited from their allotments, others sold out for a fraction of the land's worth. With the advent of statehood, many Indians took their places as leaders, and others became well-adjusted citizens in the non-Indian society. However, still today in Oklahoma, we have thousands of Indians who have made very little progress in adjusting and still cling to the traditional Indian way of life. The my civilized minds have added immeasurably to the cultural and spiritual life and to the wealth and stability of Oklahoma. Five civilized tribes are now merged into the greatest democracy that the world has ever known. We only hope and we only pray that this great democracy, these 50 states all united into one nation, shall forever remain free and democratic. Now the family.
This is Keeler, Principal Chief of the Cherokee Nation. And we're late.
Not a single soul on this island wears shoes. The ingenious Americans looked at the island and thought, there isn't a soul down here that has a pair of shoes. Now, you know, this should illustrate a point to us. And that is the way we analyze the situation and the thing that we want to do about it. And I think participating in the boards of education, where you are bringing to that board the true feeling and representation of the community, is the development of this optimistic attitude that says, this is great. We can do this. These are things we can do. And I keep thinking of it as sending a whole boatload of shoes because we've got a lot of work to do. Just last week I was in Haskell, where, as Olson mentioned, I served on the Advisory Committee for Education, talking to the young students who will be graduating later this year. And I think if I told them any one thing that was important is the fact that we must establish goals throughout our life. Now these goals will change from time to time, and we will select undoubtedly several interim goals. But when you walk into an atmosphere that you want to make an impression, if you have a goal in mind and say that this is what I want to do, you can find the help you need to do that thing. In Phillips, we have a slogan which we call, it's performance that counts. Probably many of you have never heard of the work that we have done on various Indian reservations in bringing industry to those reservations. And probably many of you do not know why we do those things. But if you will recall, in 1961, there was a presidential task force of which Bill Keeler served as chairman. And during his interviews, in those many places that they traveled, he heard time and time again the need for economic betterment, the need for an opportunity to raise not only the standards of living, but to raise the opportunity for the individual to express himself and become a full member. It was shortly after that time that Mr. Keeler brought me up to Bartlesville from Oklahoma City, where he had me handle regulatory matters, and said, you have a background now of implementation that would be meaningful on Indian reservations.